I'm glad y'all are here tonight. We are at this point in the lectionary text cycle. We are working our way through the Sermon on the Mount for a little bit of time, and it's not real detailed in the lectionary text. They kind of skip around. Tonight we'll skip around a couple like parts of different teachings and that kind of thing. So I've been telling you guys that I'm doing a month on the Mount, which means that I'm spending the entire month of February kind of going through the Sermon on the Mount just personally because I feel like I need it. Looking at Matthew 5, 6, 7, kind of right in there. It's not a whole lot. Or if you want to hear me read it, just listen to the podcast from a couple weeks ago because I just sat in here and read the whole thing. Easiest sermon I've ever done. There's so much that goes on here, but I'm excited about this because tonight what we're going to talk about is kind of a broad strokes idea that we see happening in the very beginning of the Sermon on the Mount here. Each of the little portions we talk about could warrant their own sermon for sure, but we're going to just try and talk a little bit broad strokes about something that I really think, I mean, genuinely, I know this sounds like the thing you're supposed to say at the beginning of a talk to make people believe that it's important, but I genuinely believe that this gets at what is most important about faith to me and about a lot about why we're formed as a community. And so in this part of the text, we're going to kind of jump around a little bit. There's going to be teachings on anger, on lust, on swearing oaths, all of which are fun to talk about. And so we could definitely unpack it all, but I want to get into talk kind of broad strokes. Let's go ahead and start skipping through some of these passages, though, that the lectionary has for us. I want to start just for the sake of, we'll end up going a verse before this in just a minute, but we'll start in verse 21. Matthew 5, 21 through 22 says, "You have heard that it was said to the people long ago, 'You shall not murder.' And anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. But I tell you that anyone who is angry with a brother or sister will be subject to judgment." Skip down to verse 27. "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Skip down to verse 33. "Again, you have heard it said to the people long ago, 'Do not break your oath, but fulfill to the Lord the vows you have made.' But I tell you, do not swear an oath at all, either by heaven, for it is God's throne, or by earth, for it is his footstool, or by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king. Do not swear by your head, for you cannot make even one hair white or black. All you need to say is simply yes or no. Anything beyond that comes from the evil one." And so you have these three little teachings here. And in the middle of that, we skipped over kind of the second half of what Jesus says on some of those things. We skipped over, the lectionary text doesn't talk about the portion on divorce, which I've mentioned a couple times the last couple weeks. I might say it every week because I keep pointing you guys towards the Sermon on the Mount. And that's that one part of the Sermon on the Mount I get most worried about because it's been used to just batter people over the years who have experienced divorce. And remember, context is such an important thing, and we're going to talk about the context of what Jesus says here tonight. And case in point, divorce, there's no better instance than that, where Jesus is talking about divorce and he's prohibiting it. And again, that's been used as a weapon in our day and time against people who have experienced loss in marriage. And what Jesus is doing is talking to people who, at the time, did not value women any more than they valued cattle. They were property. They were, you know, something that you kind of acquired as a man. And you could just unacquire as a man. You could just literally kind of walk out in the middle of the town and say, "I divorce you." I've read something one time where it's like you say it like out loud three times, and you're divorced. And you as a man still have all the means you need to take care of yourself and work and all that kind of thing. But in the patriarchal society of that day, the woman was just left on her own. And you're essentially forcing her into prostitution, right? And so when Jesus says, "Hey, you can't do that. I don't care what the rules say, you can't do that to someone else," it's meant to give life and it's meant to give value to someone who's not valued. It's meant to affirm the humanity of an entire group of people that were treated, again, more like animals than like people. And to then take that text and use it to dehumanize people and make them, you know, feel horrible is really, it's the opposite of what's supposed to happen right there, right? So context matters in these verses. And there's a lot of context to what happens here. And again, we could spend a week on each one of these teachings, and maybe one day we will. But I want to get into these teachings. I want to consider their context. And I want to do that because I don't want us to use them in a way that they were not intended, right? There's an important setup to these teachings from Jesus and that we shouldn't overlook. And it comes at the tail end of the section just immediately before the first thing we read there about murder. where Jesus is talking about, I did not come to abolish the law, but I came to fulfill it. You know, not one letter of the law will disappear. And in the middle of all that, as he's telling them that he's kind of the fulfillment of the law, he's not there to destroy it, he goes on to tell the congregation this in verse 20. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. So this sets the context for the, you've heard it said this, but I say this. You've heard it said this, but I say this. You've heard it said this, but I say this. Which is an authoritative claim on Jesus' part, right? You've been taught this for generations, but I'm going to reinterpret it for you the correct way, right? And there's a certain context that's happening here. Now, on first blush, when that original audience would hear something like, your righteousness has to surpass that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, this would seem like a somewhat insane thing to say. Especially from this teacher who seems to routinely disregard the rules. He constantly gets called out as a lawbreaker and as not being as righteous as the Pharisees. This teacher who tells everyone that he is the fulfillment of the law. And then he tells his followers that their righteousness has to exceed that of the Pharisees. Those who are sitting there would immediately be thinking, how? How is that possible? Right? Now, I want to get into a little bit of background here because we hear a lot of these different groups of people. You hear about like the Pharisees, or the Zealots, or the Essenes, or the Sadducees, and all these groups of people. And we just kind of mention them and pass through. But if you don't really understand who these groups of people are, then we really miss a lot of the context of what's going on here. So let's talk about the Pharisees for just for a moment. And this is going to be kind of broad strokes, but it'll give you a good idea. Understand that the Pharisees, who by the way get a really bad rap, in part because it's like the one group of people that Jesus goes off on. So that's understandable. It's somewhat earned, right? But there's also kind of this thing where now we just, Pharisee just equals self-righteous jerk, right? That's what we just think of. Someone's a Pharisee, they're just a self-righteous jerk. But it's a little more nuanced than that. They kind of get a bad rap, I would say. But you have to understand that these Pharisees are, they're men, of course, not women in that culture, and they follow the law more closely, they take it more seriously, they study it longer. They are righteousness. In that culture, they are the pinnacle of how righteous you can be in people's understanding, right? They study it from a very young age. And for the Pharisees, they study and learn and practice not only the written law, so the what you call maybe the first five books of our Old Testament, not only the written law, but also what's called the oral tradition. And the oral tradition is basically the generations of rabbis and teachers who take what's written and then expound on it, right? I mean, like I do every week, I'm expounding. I don't just read the Bible, except a couple weeks ago. It was lazy, I admit. But who expound on it, right? So they not only kind of follow the written law, but they also go even wider and they follow the oral tradition. That's one of the main things that separates them from the Sadducees. The Sadducees are only about what's written, okay? And so if it's not specifically written, then it's kind of fair game. And that's why you'll see the Sadducees work with the Romans. You'll see them, they actually, a lot of times, are a little better off financially. They're kind of the rich guys. It's because they're working with the people that are dominating the people of God, right? Because it doesn't specifically say in the first five books, it doesn't specifically say in the law, don't work with the Romans, so hey, we can work with the Romans, right? So they're very kind of literal, only if it's written. The oral tradition is not binding to them. It's why they don't believe in the afterlife. Sadducees don't believe in the afterlife because it's not specifically written, right? And you remember our shorthand for this? We've told this before. The Sadducees don't believe in the afterlife, and that's why they're sad, you see, right? There you go. You can wow all your friends with that later on. But the Pharisees take not just the written law, but the oral tradition very, very seriously. And I want to try and give you a little bit of an idea of what that means for them. So the Mishnah, which is one of the kind of bodies of oral interpretation, if you were to kind of print it out, the one thing I was reading today was talking about, or this week was talking about, how the Mishnah was essentially 700 pages of small print. And there are some segments of these teachers and Pharisees who are known to memorize the entire thing. 700 pages of small print, right? If you just go to the idea of Sabbath and what you can and can't do in the Sabbath, there are 240 paragraphs on Sabbath behavior alone in the oral tradition in the Mishnah. And there's more oral tradition besides just the Mishnah, too. So they get a bad rap. We think of them as self-righteous and mean and all those kind of things, which certainly they can be, and Jesus calls them out on. But you are talking about a group of people who take God very seriously. They have literally given every part of their life to it. They try to order every part of their life by God's teaching. They are trying to follow God in the best possible way that they can. Right? So they may be wrong on some things, but we should at least give them the credit of being sincerely wrong, if they're wrong, right? And being a lot more dedicated to it than most of us are. I mean, it was everything, you know, if you're supposed to give away 10%, and Jesus ends up kind of, you know, addressing this specifically, they wouldn't just give away 10% of, you know, their gross income as opposed to their net. That was a big argument in my church growing up for some reason. But they're going to get down into their spices and divvy up 10% and give it to the church, even the little minutia, right? They go all the way down. So this is the Pharisees. The Pharisees, you can't get more righteous than the Pharisees. They weren't separatists like the Essenes, who would kind of go off into the desert and practice their spirituality apart from the kingdoms of the world and just kind of do their own thing. They weren't Sadducees, who were only kind of the written law and would kind of work with the kingdom. They weren't the Zealots, who said, okay, well, God is for us and we're against them, so God is against them, let's pick up arms and go attack. They weren't violent like them. They believed that as soon as the certain kind of critical mass of the Israelites were finally acting the way God wanted them to act, and you hear a lot of this kind of talk today as well, as soon as enough people are kind of holy enough, whatever that magic number is, that tipping point, that's when the Messiah comes back, and that's when God delivers Israel. That's when all these. So they're doing their best to bring the Messiah and to bring God into this world and all those things. They were holy. They were completely dedicated to God and religious practice, right? Following the oral law and the written law was no joke. But what they tended to do was you tend to take this thing, maybe that's written in the law, and then you have the oral tradition around it and then another oral tradition, and then you kind of keep building on top of it. So I want to give you another little example, because this will help illustrate why Jesus ends up teaching what he teaches. So let's look at the Sabbath, even though that's not what Jesus addresses specifically, but it's a good example. So you have this kind of core teaching that it starts off with in the written law, and it's this idea of we as the people of God resting as God rested, right? They were slaves in Egypt. They were delivered by God. They were defined by the work they did. And then in the desert, God forms them into new people. And one of the couple things that God focuses on while they're in the desert as he's reforming the people is the Sabbath. This idea that you are not defined by what you produce with your hands. I know you've been a slave, and that's all you think of. In your mind, you are a slave. I only matter if I produce, you know? And there's this idea of resting. That is not what you were defined by. You sit still for a moment, and you just are the beloved child of God. You are who, like this idea of rest, right? What a gift for people who have for generations been enslaved. And so this is part of the written law, this idea of everyone resting. Well, then you have all these people kind of expound on it after year, and you start adding layers around that circle. So that circle is this idea of rest. Sorry. That wasn't dramatic pause at all. It was bad timing. It's going to be awesome for those listening to the podcast. So they go, okay, well, if I'm going to rest, that means I can't work. Okay, so we add that circle. Don't work. All right, well, what does work mean? Well, you know, if you prepare meals, that's hard work preparing meals. They didn't have microwaves back then. That's hard work. So don't fix food on the Sabbath, because then you're working. And if you're working, then you're not resting, right? So, okay, no cooking. So we have rest, don't work, don't cook. And they say, man, well, you know, there's a lot of other things are kind of hard work too. You know what? I tell you what, actually don't carry any money. If you carry any money, then you might be tempted to do business with someone. And if you do business with someone, then you're going to be working. And if you're working, then you're not resting. So let's draw that other circle too. Don't carry money. And then they say, well, you know, it's the desert. It's hot. I don't know if this is the reason behind it. It's the desert. It's hot. We've got sandals. I don't even have Nikes. If I walk far enough on any given day out here, that's got to constitute work. especially if, you know, if I haven't eaten much that day because I didn't, you know, prepare food that day. So let's figure it out. Let's say 3,000 feet. This is an actual thing, like 1,500 steps, 3,000 feet. So you can't go, if you walk more than 3,000 steps in a day, and they didn't have a Fitbit, I mean, this had to be hard to keep up with, right? If I walk more than 3,000 steps, then that means I'm working, and if I'm working, then I'm not resting. If I'm not resting, then I'm violating the Sabbath. And so you end up having this core truth, and it ends up becoming this thing, right? Layer after layer after layer on top of it. And the Pharisees take the outside layer just as seriously as they take the inside layer, right? I mean, they kind of work from the outside in that sense. And so you keep all this stuff way out here, and then you're never in danger of violating this thing in here, right? You are pure, you are holy. And there's even, and then of course what happens with anyone, this works with every human being, is whenever you kind of establish what the rules are, then I figure out how do I get my toes right up to that line, or how do I circumvent it in some way, right? And so there's ends up being things like, well, cook your food the day before, then walk a certain amount of steps away, bury some of that food, and then it's legal to double your steps because you get to eat partway through, but you didn't prepare that food that day, right? Or you have someone that's non-Jewish that comes to your house and cooks the food for you. Right? Which is, that's a pretty awesome workaround. He's like, I can't cook today. You're not Jewish, you can cook today. So whip me up something real quick and I'm gonna eat it, right? And so, yeah, we kind of did that same thing when I was growing up. You weren't supposed to work on Sundays, but we went to Morrison's every week and ate, right? And people had to work there. And that was fine because they were godless heathens. So they were allowed to work. I'm just kidding, no godless heathen could make that kind of chop steak. So it was, but, you know, there's this kind of idea, and you end up kind of trying to find these workarounds, but they really obeyed these laws. But the problem is, pretty soon, you're spending all your time and energy a long ways away from that essential thing, from the heart of what it began as. And eventually, right, this whole Sabbath thing, let's be honest, eventually, I need to take Monday off because not working has become a lot of work on the Sabbath. And so eventually you end up violating the very thing that you're trying to protect in the beginning. I'm doing all this work to make sure I don't work, to make sure I rest, and you're missing the entire point from the get-go. And that's why you see Jesus violating some of the oral tradition in regards to the Sabbath. They're picking food when they're hungry in their field, and he's healing, which they consider work, and he's doing these things, and he's going, you don't understand what this is really about, all about. And he says, eventually ends up saying, the Sabbath is for man. The man is not for the Sabbath. Like, you're working for the Sabbath now. That's not how it's supposed to be. Sabbath is a gift to us, right? You're missing the point. I would argue that this entire section of the Sermon on the Mount, really the entire Sermon on the Mount in some ways, is meant to be a corrective to that approach, as sincere as it may have been. It course corrects on at least two fronts, I think. First, it gets back to the heart of what was intended in the first place for all these, this kind of seed that grew all this law. And secondly, it puts religious practice back in the realm of horizontal relationships and not just vertical. So let's unpack both of those and then we'll call it a night. So this idea of getting back to the seed, getting back to the heart of what it is. Rather than adding another layer to the oral tradition, Christ pulls out the heart of the original law. You have heard it said, but I say, right? You have heard it said, do not murder. And they say, yes, we have heard it. It's in the Bible. And instead of adding another layer to the outside of this command, Jesus roots out the heart of it, the internal posture of the murderer, the roots of what's going on instead of the fruit of where that comes from. Jesus gets at that which produces the prohibited act, anger. It doesn't just mean that uncontrollable emotion that we all experience and Jesus experienced and God experiences, it says in the Bible. But that moment when we as human beings choose to make someone else the object of our hatred, the icon of all that is evil. And you know how that goes, right? It's not just, it's that extra step you make. It's not like, oh, they kind of ticked me off. But it's that person you don't get along with at work that suddenly represents all that is evil in the world. Somehow they are just Mussolini and Hitler and Stalin all wrapped up in a cubicle next to you, you know. They become that icon of all that is evil. They're no longer God's beloved child. They're no longer made in the image of God. They are no longer an object that we are called, or a person that we are called to engage in and love. They are now an object of hatred. That dehumanizing choice that is made in our heart before murder, that posture that happens before murder could ever be dreamed of. That's what Jesus gets at. You've heard it said, do not commit adultery. But instead of adding another layer on top of this command, again, Jesus pulls out the heart, the root, the internal posture of the adulterer. Jesus addresses that which produces adultery. Lust. Objectification. That choice that we make in our own hearts to view someone's not as God's beloved child, but as a means to an end that I desire. An object to be used for my pleasure. A thing that exists to serve me, to serve my desires. An object to be used, not a child of God, to be loved. It's the dehumanizing choice we make before adultery even becomes something we would consider. You have heard it said, do not swear falsely. But instead of adding another layer on the outside of this, Jesus gets at the heart of it, the internal posture of those making these oaths that appeal to something outside of ourselves to validate and bolster our word. And I was thinking about this, this is kind of a weird one. The murder one, awesome. Like the adultery one, you kind of get it right away. And this oaths one feels a little bit weird. But I think it gets at that thing where, this is definitely true of kids when they get a little bit older. And I used to think I was so smart with my parents. Like now that I'm a parent, I realize I was dumb and they were just being nice to me. But I really thought I was getting away with a lot that I know now I wasn't. Because I can even remember some of my own logic and thinking, some of the things that came out of my mouth that I thought, good one, Mike, got them. That I know that they just had to laugh at as soon as I turned around, right? But you do this thing where when I appeal to something higher, right, it's to bolster a weak case. It's to make, like, you know, if someone comes up, if a cop walks up to a group of people and says, you know, all right, who stole the loaf of bread? And this person says, nope, I didn't do it. And this person goes, I swear to God and on the grave of my ancestors and on all that is holy, I have never even looked at bread that I would consider stealing. That person's guilty, right? You know that person is guilty, right? And I think it gets at whatever we have set up in our life that leads us to the point where we have to appeal to something larger in order to say, no, this time I'm actually telling the truth. Right? And to that tendency we have to manipulate others, to choose our words carefully so that we get what we want from other people instead of just letting our yes be yes and our no be no. Jesus says, don't swear any oaths. Just say yes or say no. Tell the truth. Whatever is going on in your heart, whatever is at the root of that need, you feel the need to appeal to something higher, work on that, right? Gets at the heart of this thing. Combat that posture of our heart that participates in dehumanizing other people, that objectifies other people, that manipulates other people. Jesus essentially calls us back to the heart of the law, the reason why it exists in the first place. Or to quote Jesus, to remind us that if we love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love our neighbor as ourselves, all the law hangs on this. It all comes from here. That's what it's all about. Jesus calls us back to the love from which all the law springs forth, right? Jesus calls us back to that place. The what we do will spring naturally from the who we are. The what is not the point in and of itself. The what only bears witness to the authentic who, right? And that authentic who, the creation, what kind of creation we are, that is what is of the utmost concern to Christ. Because if I don't objectify, if I don't lust, I'm not going to commit adultery. If I don't get angry, if I don't villainize a fellow human being, I'm not going to murder. If I don't manipulate with words, if I don't try and control people and get what I want out of people selfishly, I'm not going to need to appeal to a higher authority when I say yes or no. It's the who that I am, the heart of things that Jesus gets to. And he also reminds us, the second thing is, he gets at the heart of it, but he also reminds us of the horizontal nature of things. In other words, he reminds us that the loving of neighbor is equivalent to the loving of the Lord our God. Jesus always keeps those two things together, and that's very important. Because each of these things also calls us back to the priority of how we treat one another, how we love the person that is in front of us. all of the above laws in the kind of traditional senses could be obeyed without actually loving the person in front of me. I cannot murder someone and still not love them. There's a lot of people in this world that I don't love and have not yet murdered. Really, I mean, it's a long, I mean, at least 20 people, 25 or more. I cannot commit adultery and still objectify and devalue a person that I see. I cannot make a false oath and still scheme to manipulate others with what I say and don't say in strategic ways. I can be good by the law, and therefore, if you interpret it that way, I can be good in relationship to my God. I obeyed the rules, God and I are good, and still not be in good relationship with my neighbor. You can love God and not those in front of you. Except Jesus does not allow for such separation. This is, to me, this is so important. Jesus allows no separation. Love of neighbor is love of God. I cannot love my God and hate my neighbor. I can't do it. Those two things cannot exist at the same time. I cannot stay within the rules and still dehumanize, objectify, and manipulate. If it compromises my love of neighbor, then my love of God is null and void. I think this is hands down the biggest hurdle we've placed between people and faith. I had a conversation on Friday night, someone I've been friends with for a while, who is not a person of faith, didn't grow up in church, didn't, you know, kind of said, look, I don't mean to offend you, but I don't really believe that whole Jesus thing. I was like, okay, yeah. I'm not daring you, but it takes more than that to offend me. And then we started having this conversation, and I mean, one of the reasons why he's never setting foot in church, and hopefully will at some point, is that everyone who claims to be God is a jerk. Not everyone, but a whole lot of the people he knows, right? I mean, they talk about love and they talk about all this stuff, but they're cruel to their neighbor. They work against their neighbors around them. They don't support, they don't love, they don't do any of those things. And he cannot figure that out. Somehow we have found a way to make those two things work at the same time. Anyone who stands outside the church sees it for the lie that it is. I don't get to say I love God and hate my neighbor. Ask anyone who refuses to go to church or who's outside the church, and I guarantee that comes up at some point, and they see it for what it is. Somehow we fooled ourselves into thinking those two things can exist at the same time. If nothing else, and there is a lot more, but at the very least, the Sermon on the Mount and what Jesus teaches and how Jesus behaves in this world eliminates that separation, no longer allows us to take those two things and act like they are different things. It's incredibly, incredibly important. If something compromises my love of neighbor, then it compromises my love of God. And one of the most immediate ways to know that you should avoid any particular religious expression, one of the ways you'll know never to come back to Ecclesia, is if somehow when you come here, we enable you to be right with God while at the same time not okay with your neighbors. If anything we ever do or teach endorses that you can be right with God while demonizing, avoiding, manipulating, objectifying, hating, or ignoring your neighbor, if that ever happens in this place or whatever other faith expression you're a part of, if that happens, that's when you know it's time to leave. I mean, you can choose that and you can call it whatever you want. Just don't call it Jesus. You can call it Christian. You can slap a silver fish on the back of it and you can sing songs all day long, but it has nothing to do with Jesus. Jesus does not allow for the separation of those things. In fact, by the teachings that Jesus has here, in that case, you should leave, right? You should, if it causes that, you should cut it off and throw it in the fire, right? It's better to lose your hand or your eye or your religion than to have your whole life consumed by the death that it brings. Jesus calls us to this difficult work of paying attention to who we are, to the type of creation that we are, to the roots of what makes us us, to attending to our hearts so that we might love our neighbor as ourselves. To pay attention to who we are and how we love each other. This is what Jesus teaches. So the challenge before us today is to figure out how we do this kind of religion. How within our own hearts and our own theology and our own religious expression, how we root out each of those things that allows us to be okay by the rules and less loving to the person in front of us. And to see that for what it is and to root it out. Because thankfully, Jesus made no such separation. And neither should we. Let's pray.